But we start this week by looking at the child abuse. This week, yes, another one. South Yorkshire have released a report that 1,200 underage young people have been sexually exploited, but the police nor social services have done anywhere near enough about it. Is Britain now officially the child abuse capital of the world? Or are we just the only country with the courage to acknowledge and deal with this problem? Well, to discuss that and other things, I'm joined on the line by the former Senator, Stuart Siveray from Jersey. Hi, Stuart, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you come across child abuse in Jersey with the Haute de la Garenne scandal there?
Well, it wasn't just Haute de la Garenne. There were a number of very serious child protection failings in Jersey. The kind of way I evolved into the position is that I was from outside of the Jersey establishment, really. I'm an ordinary working person. I got elected at quite a young age, at the age of 25. And in spite of the best efforts of Jersey's establishment, I was succeeding politically. And I eventually ended up becoming the president of the island's Health and Social Services Committee and then the Minister for Health and Social Services. And I had that position for several years. And what happened was towards the end of 2006, a number of whistleblowers began to approach me, frontline staff initially, then other witnesses, then victims of different examples of child abuse. And this was deeply concerning to me, so I began inquiring into it myself in late 2006 and early 2007. And I obviously began to ask questions of my very senior staff, the senior managers, the relevant executives of the department. And what evolved over a period of several months is that it became clear that I was being overtly and extremely seriously lied to by the senior management, who were simply telling complete falsehoods to me and actually striving to cover up what was a systemic and endemic long-term catalogue of child protection failure.
Could you just give us an example of the sort of thing that a whistleblower would come to you with and then the replies that you would get from your officials?
Oh, certainly. For example, up until the end of 2006, children with mental health issues were being essentially arrested and jailed in the island's child secure unit. And any kind of problematic behaviour, which obviously these kind of children invariably had, would be punished with lengthy regimes of solitary confinement. And this went on in some cases for months. Essentially, mentally ill children at the age of 13, 14, 15 were being held in solitary confinement regimes for weeks and months at a stretch in essentially concrete cells and not allowed to mingle with other children. Now, this was simply grotesque, absolutely abominable. It was child abuse, of course, in itself, and it was illegal. And I was simply lied to and told a variety of falsehoods by the senior managers in connection with that issue when I was trying to expose it. Eventually, the whistleblowers and I were exonerated by a fully independent report from the Howard League for Penal Reform. But essentially, what happened was that in July 2007, I made my concerns public when answering a question in the Jersey Parliament. And this led, although I didn't know it at that time, to a wholly illegal conspiracy of senior civil servants from Jersey's public sector and the Crown officers, advised by the then Attorney General, to essentially engineer my dismissal as minister because I was exposing these child protection failings.
Well, that's interesting, because we're just talking about, in a few minutes, the similar kind of thing going on in the National Health Service, where whistleblowers are being dismissed, other things are being found, turning it into an employment issue, and they've got out of the way so that the problems that they're raising within the health service are not dealt with, and then that person will go onto a blacklist. But tell us about these Crown agents. How do things work down in Jersey? Because I imagine it's one step removed from the British mainland government.
The actual way power works in Jersey is very, very strange. It essentially is the power of the Crown in a much more intense and direct way than perhaps you would be used to in the UK, where you have the constitutional monarchy. Power in the Crown dependencies, those are the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, is still very much influenced directly by the Crown and the monarchy itself. And the actual real officers of power in Jersey, the Solicitor General, Attorney General, Deputy Bailiff, Bailiff and Lieutenant Governor, are all appointed directly and expressly by the crown. They are empowered via what is called letters patent, given to them by the monarch. So essentially those public officers, those crown officers, in truth, wield all meaningful power in Jersey. And it's especially difficult because Jersey has no functioning fourth estate. There's a lot of media in Jersey for the size of the island, but all of the mainstream media is owned and run by the local establishment. And the only effective media that's done the necessary investigative journalism in Jersey over the last 4, 5, or 6 years have been the bloggers, people like Voice for Children, Rico Sorda, and myself, Stuart Sivray, on the what is now the Free Speech Offshore blog. So we are effectively challenging not only the obviously dangerous and deficient public authorities in Jersey, we're also having to fight against a wholly overtly complicit local mainstream media.
Okay, so how did this did you first hear about the allegations of abuse at Haute de la Garenne, and what then transpired?
I heard some rumours about Haute de la Garenne and some stories, but I mean, essentially Haute de la Garenne had closed in 1986, so the cases relating to that place were old, but still obviously very, very important. And it was actually mainly the States of Jersey Police Force under the then leadership, the good leadership of Graham Power, the Chief Police Officer, and Lenny Harper, the Deputy Chief Police Officer. They looked into the Haute de la Garenne case in particular, and they began a covert investigation, which quite purely by coincidence paralleled my own investigations as minister into the more recent and other examples of abuse which happened across a variety of institutions in Jersey. I mean, people might remember the controversy, and that kind of rumbled on from 2007 and into 2008. But at the end of 2008, the police chief, Graham Power, was illegally suspended in what was plainly just a criminal conspiracy by the island's government and the Crown officers. And, you know, these are the kind of problems we deal with in Jersey. There is no functioning checks and balances. For example, a former senior investigating officer, the deputy chief officer of the police, Lenny Harper, has said in interviews that there are at least 4 priority abuse suspects still in positions of power and influence and public authority in Jersey. So these are the kind of issues we have to deal with. And it's not only our view. I mean, for example, the Leeds businessman, Ken Bates, you know, quite a well-known figure, recently was interviewed on radio in the United Kingdom about an absolutely appalling series of years he's had to fight a legal case in Jersey, a business-related case. And he has said simply that the judicial system in Jersey is basically dysfunctional and corrupt. And it is. It's wholly politicised, and it is the entity through which power is abused.
Okay, it's also known, very well known, as a tax haven. Maybe not necessarily so well known as a place to drugs are brought in and out of the United Kingdom. But Stuart, what would you say about the possible links between some of the abuse you're saying, you know, senior people in the Jersey government being criminals, and the fact that it's actually a tax haven too, and this link really with the direct control by the Crown? I think it's just interesting to see how you think those actual power structures work, and I suppose if there's any kind of real thought about reforming them.
Obviously some of us want to reform the situation in Jersey, because all power in Jersey is to all practical intents and purposes in the hands of the Crown officers, and the democracy such as it is in Jersey is essentially a charade. It's a Potemkin village, much indeed as the prosecution and the judicial functions are. And for example, in the course of 2008, when the child abuse investigations were at their height, the sole prosecuting authority in Jersey, the Crown-appointed Attorney General, was known to be associating with certain priority abuse suspects. And naturally enough, that sole prosecutor then decided not to have them charged or prosecuted. Now, people in Jersey have got no recourse over this. Those people, the Attorney General, Solicitor General, Bailiff, Deputy Bailiff, Lieutenant Governor, are appointed directly by London. Now, I and other people have made numerous complaints to the authorities in London, the Crown, the Privy Council, and the Secretary of State for Justice, because they do have ultimate constitutional and legal responsibility for good governance and the proper rule of law in Jersey. Our complaints are invariably ignored. We don't even get faintly credible answers. the situation in Jersey is that the apparatus here, as it were, this kind of fake democracy and this fake lawful jurisdiction, is protected by the powers that be in London. It suits London, and it suits the City of London Corporation to have this kind of status quo in Jersey where things might look nice and quaint and respectable on the surface. But if you delve underneath it, of course, you find massive dysfunction. Now, obviously, the City of London Corporation is a quite strange and archaic little enclave in itself. It has peculiar constitutional rights and powers.
Yeah, it's a bit like a state within its state, and I think I'm right in saying that even the Queen has to ask permission if she wants to visit the City of London.
That's absolutely correct. The actual British monarch is, in certain important ways, actually subservient to and is an agent of the City of London Corporation, and that is actually laid down in Magna Carta, and it's one of the few actually remaining existing clauses in Magna Carta that remains actually in force rather than being superseded by modern legislation. Now, Jersey is essentially the City of London's kind of offshore backyard. It's kind of boiler house where things are perhaps even a bit too dodgy in legal and constitutional and international financial and legal terms to do in the City of London, kind of get done in Jersey. The city boys have an expression, Jersey or jail. So the stuff that they do for their international clients, you know, these are the big accountancy firms, the bankers, the big legal practices that exist in London, anything that's a bit too dodgy even for them to do there, gets done via Jersey. And obviously the lobby that we face is simply insurmountable. The local media in Jersey is owned by these people, so it's immensely difficult to compete against it. Only us bloggers have ever tried to do that. And the real power that could intervene to clean up Jersey and fix this place and give us something like an independent, you know, proper judiciary and a proper prosecution system, that power resides in London. But of course, that power is under the immense influence of the City of London Corporation and all of the various politicians. And
but Stuart, you are officially, surely you're part of the European Union. Can't you appeal to Brussels?
Well, we're not actually part of the European Union. Jersey is not a member of the EU. So appealing to Brussels doesn't so much enter the equation, although Jersey is actually bound by the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the fundamental instrument of the Council of Europe, which is a different, a broader body of states than the European Union. But our difficulty is, if you take a case to the European Court of Human Rights, that institution will only look at broad fundamental principles. It will not and does not delve into the details.
So you're banging your head against a brick wall in Brussels as well. But what does the your experience, because we've had, since the Hotel Edgar Wren scandal in Jersey, we've had all sorts of other of these abuse scandals going on. I mean, the most notable, obviously, is the Jimmy Savile scandal, which is also, funnily enough, linked to the royal family, as Savile was very friendly, particularly with Prince Charles. And what does that, those other scandals, what do you think you've seen that, you know, that you can throw some light on what's been happening here? Because I heard you talk about having real problems with the media there, not being able to get your voice heard as much as you'd like on the Jersey media in order to, I suppose, to create a kind of atmosphere where it's something is done about criminals who are still in power. But of course, Savile was very, very loved, supposedly, anyway, at the BBC. So he, it seems, was very, very clever at getting into the media here. Now, I just wonder what you think, what you felt when you saw this scandal unfolding here in Britain of somebody that had been supposedly embraced by the whole society, including Margaret Thatcher, the NSPCC, and the BBC. It suddenly turns out to be the biggest abuser that the country's ever known.
Well, I was aware of certain abuse instances committed by Jimmy Savile, because he actually came to Jersey very often and was strongly connected to the island. So I was aware that there were victims of Savile in Jersey. So when that story erupted, it didn't come wholly surprising to me, although the sheer scale and nature of the depravity of this individual obviously was simply breathtaking. But of course, it's an illustration, isn't it, of the fact that these people, when they've got these kind of connections with the media, with the BBC, for had good, strong links, you know, with the BBC in Jersey, and the BBC in Jersey have been atrocious, I'm afraid, in helping to expose these issues and providing any kind of balance. But yes, it's absolutely remarkable. I mean, Savile came to Jersey a lot. He had a lot of connections here with local people and with the BBC in Jersey. He committed acts of abuse here. It's been suggested that he engaged in necrophilia and abusing people with mental health issues in certain institutions in the United Kingdom. Now, I was in charge of Jersey's Health and Social Services Department, and if you were to say to me, could I guarantee you that Savile didn't commit such acts against, well, corpses or mentally ill adults in Jersey, frankly, no, I couldn't. And if it emerged that he had acted in that way in Jersey, I wouldn't be in the least surprised.
So do you think we've got anything in the wider UK, in Westminster, London, in Britain, to learn from your experience in Jersey?
I think the situation is well illustrated by looking at the Savile case, actually. I mean, who would have believed, you know, had you written this before, that this man had these hundreds and thousands of victims and so many people were aware of it?
But even when the Newsnight reporter managed to get people on camera who'd been abused by him, Peter Rippon, the Newsnight editor, said, oh, we're not going to run that because we've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up. And then subsequently that story was written up by a freelance journalist, Miles Goslett. He couldn't get any of the national newspapers in Britain to print it. And he also then went to people like Private Eye. They wouldn't print it. He finally got it printed in the Oldie. And we've just heard in May this year that even the editor of the Oldie has now been sacked. So one wonders if there is another Savile out there in the next story, where is it ever going to be heard?
Well, that's absolutely right. So you can see in that case, I mean, some people, one of the problems we face in Jersey is that, you know, the media kind of try to brush us aside, saying, oh, you're just a load of, you know, conspiracy theorists and so on, and there aren't these kind of cover-ups. But of course, the Savile case disproves that. You know, we can look at the Savile case and we can see absolutely, as you correctly just itemised, actual, real, evidenced, documented examples of the atrocities of this maniac being covered up, and covered up at the highest levels by our media institutions that we like to trust. So, yes, I'm afraid there will be other maniacs out there who have been covered up and who are still being covered up. And for example, I have a tremendous amount of evidence about the cover-ups in Jersey, including an immensely detailed and important 94-page statement prepared by the former police chief, Graham Power. Now, I actually gave this document. I was the source. I obtained a copy and gave it to the BBC in Jersey, coming up for 3 years ago now, and the BBC in Jersey have flatly refused to report any of the very serious public interest issues which arise from that document. So this is how it unfolds. This is real, this is evidenced, it's happening now, the mainstream media going along with these kind of cover-ups. Jersey's bloggers are the only people who have stepped into the breach, really, where the Fourth Estate should be. And, you know, we face immense difficulties. We're unresourced, we're oppressed by the local authorities. You know, I've been prosecuted and even jailed for contempt of court under the so-called data protection law in Jersey for exposing a case that clearly was covered up, which involved an obviously mentally deranged male nurse clearly committing a series of murders in the Jersey hospital in 1999. Now, again, this is another whole different atrocity which has been covered up by the Jersey's mainstream media in collusion with Jersey's public authorities, which are supposed to protect people from these kind of dangers.
Well, Theresa May, the Home Secretary, a few weeks ago, after Norman Tebbit spoke out about this historic abuse, started two inquiries. One was a long-term one to report after the next general election, conveniently, and that was to be chaired by Elizabeth Butler-Schloss. She, within a week, had resigned because it turned out that her brother, I think it was the Attorney General during when this abuse had been covered up back in the 1980s. And then there was another inquiry set up with Peter Wanless running it, looking into the lost, I think it was just, was it 100 and 40, I think, documents handed to the Home Secretary in the 1980s that had all been lost by the police, with allegations of abuse of around about 20 public figures, people that everyday names that people would know, and that had all been lost. Peter Wanless is looking into that, but he is the former civil servant to Michael Portillo, who was himself accused of being involved in some kind of sex scandal cover-up when he was Minister of Defence. So one wonders if it's going to be possible at all to get to the bottom of this. There is, although, there is a campaign to get Michael Mansfield QC, someone who's rather more trusted and outside the establishment a little bit, to run the inquiry. So it seems that even the inquiries that the Home Secretary has put together, Stuart, are immediately hit the buffers, and it's very difficult to see how someone like Wanless from the NSPCC, which Jimmy Savile was a major fundraiser for, of course, would be really trusted to run these inquiries properly.
It's difficult. I mean, I was frankly astonished when it was announced that Elizabeth Butler-Schloss was going to be the nominee, as it were, the chair for the inquiry, and I knew immediately that it just wasn't going to happen and she would have to resign within weeks. It was simply that obvious. She was so conflicted from the outset, even assuming she did approach the investigation with good faith, she was so conflicted from the outset her position would have been impossible. So you have to wonder at the competency of the advice that was given to the cabinet ministers at the time, even made the selection. Quite how these inquiries are going to unfold and what they're going to uncover, I don't know. I mean, we're very used in the UK, aren't we, to all kinds of atrocities being kind of put on the back burner, as it were, by various public inquiries, which we end up having to have one, two, three or four public inquiries over a period of decades before we eventually get to the truth, like Bloody Sunday, like Hillsborough and so on. I'm hopeful that the child abuse atrocities will be investigated much more effectively and more speedily than that. And one of the things I think that we have on our side that campaigners didn't have and civil society didn't have those years ago is the internet, our ability to communicate, our ability to make the news ourselves, and our ability to actually report the facts ourselves. I think that puts now immense pressure on corrupt authorities and authorities who are essentially under the control of certain lobbies. And, you know, I have to praise, for example, most strongly the work that's been done by independent journalists such as XRO News, who have done excellent investigative and campaigning work in the whole field of the child abuse crimes and the child abuse cover-ups. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult now for the customary British establishment to carry on maintaining the cover-ups, certainly in the United Kingdom. I think in the peculiar little quasi-jurisdictions of the Crown dependencies, where we simply have no functioning checks or balances at all, it's going to be more difficult, and we're campaigning and we would like to hope that the authorities in London will eventually see they can't carry on protecting and associating with this manifestly lawless polity in Jersey, and that they've got to intervene and clean it up. So we're hoping that the Crown dependencies such as Jersey will be included in the national investigation. There will be an immense lobby from the usual suspects, City of London and the other lobbies, to keep Jersey out of it. But I think if we're looking at an era of responsible governance, then I think the authorities in London are going to have to clean up Jersey and bring Jersey into the fold of proper lawful checks and balances.
How high do you think this goes? Right the way up to royalty? Because it just seemed that they've been involved both with the Savile case and your case.
You know, I can't. I mean, obviously, there are some, you know, rather extreme and fanciful theories that sometimes float around about the royal family. I like to be fairly robust in respect of the evidence and the you know, analysis I bring to all of these cases. So, what I, you know, can say for certain is that the royal family has a very significant degree of power over the Crown dependencies. The monarchy, the monarch and the royal household, which is essentially all of the very wide and far-reaching range of offices that members of the royal family have under their control. The royal household does have a tremendous amount of power and influence over the Crown dependencies, far more so than the royal family and the monarchy does have in the United Kingdom. So certainly there has got to be some serious thought given as to how that power can be made more accountable, and how a similar degree of accountability can be brought to it as has been in place in the United Kingdom via the Act of Settlement for some centuries now.
Okay, Stuart Siveray, former Senator down in Jersey, thanks ever so much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.